Yeah, so again, welcome to the fifth lecture of our Greenhorns machine learning course. Before we start with the lecture itself, are there any questions? Not so far. So you have probably noticed that some of the assignments are a bit more challenging than they were at the beginning of the course. So please count with this and allow yourself enough time to be actually able to work on them, to do them. It's not like that you have, like, you are expected to solve the assignments without any issues. So what I mean is that at the beginning of the course, you probably didn't know machine learning you wanted to learn something. So it's actually normal if you cannot solve the assignments. And the lecture could give you some theory, but the lecture doesn't give you all the practical knowledge which you also need to do it, to debug the problems, to find bugs and so on. So it can easily happen that you have done your best, you have implemented the algorithm according to the lecture, but it doesn't work. Either it doesn't give the same outputs as the official examples, or it doesn't pass in recodex. So this is perfectly normal. And if this happens and you, I don't know, you spend 30 minutes trying to debug the problem and you just cannot move from the place, then the normal procedure is to write and to get help. Either write to all the instructors on Piazza, private note, ideally submit the source code to recodex before, and then just tell us, oh, my source is in recodex and it doesn't work for this and this reason, or I don't know how to do this or something. Even if you just don't know how to implement various to-do notes, it's fine to ask. It also makes sense to ask the other students if you want some specific problem, like you want to solve, like you don't know what happens or what should happen on one line of code or something. Then if you ask everybody, it can happen that you will get your answer faster than the instructors will get to it. So feel free, please, to use all this, all these channels to find out how to do the assignments. Also, we had one competition assignment which already ended. The other one will end on Tuesday midnight. On the Wednesday practicals, we will spend time talking about both of these competitions. So I will show you, you can see the results already in the recodex, but I will show you various solutions, how good they would be, whether some feature engineering helps and even some algorithms which you weren't allowed to use, but you already know whether they would help and so on. So this will normally follow after a competition ends, but given that we didn't have the practicals on Wednesday, it has been postponed for the next ones. Also, I promised you that we will talk about the gradient computation in the softmax regression and also in the MLP, or in the neural network with some hidden layer. So we will definitely do the computation on the assignments, on the practicals, so that if you either don't want to do it by yourself or you try to do it by yourself, but for some reason it doesn't work, then you will see how it can be done. So that are just the plans. Any questions came in mind during me talking? Nope. Then let's get to the lecture itself. Today the lecture is going to be composed of various minor topics, so it won't be that coherent, but it will get better on the next one. First, I want to talk about Lagrange multipliers. We have already, when we were training the model on the data, what we did is we try to minimize the loss or error function, right? In other words, we try to maximize the likelihood of the data. And when we want to find the maximum of a function, then what we do, well, we investigate the so-called critical points, the points where the derivative of the function, or the whole, all the derivatives, or all the partial derivatives of the function, which means the gradient of the function, is zero. And there is this theorem that if you have a continuous function and it has maximum or minimum in a point, then these partial derivatives or this gradient has to have a value of zero, right? It doesn't go the other way around. So if you have a gradient of zero, it doesn't mean you are in a minimum or maximum. You can be in a saddle point as well, but it's a necessary condition. And so that's what we did, right? When we were optimizing the model, we just went downhill and trying to find a point where these gradients would be all zeros, and that would be our trained model. And this optimization is so-called an unconstrained optimization, because we don't really have any special, like any additional constraints. Any set of weights can be used, can be the optimum or minimum. However, sometimes we have some constraints. It may be the case that we have some function which will compute the like which we want to maximize, but only some of the inputs are valid. So we have some constraint, and on this image we have a constraint gx equals to zero, which is this this red potato. Right. So let's say that we want to find maximum subject to the given potato constraint. I will show you how it can be done. I will not be proving the theorem, which I will show you. I assume you have probably already seen the proof. If I think at least it was taught on calculus here or on MFF, but maybe I'm wrong. But anyway, I will show you like the motivation and why, like an idea why the theorem holds, and I will just skip the proof. But know that there is no danger sum sign. So we will actually use this even in multiple lectures in the future, right? So it's good to know the method, know how it works. So first, an observation. The observation is that the gradient of G is actually orthogonal to the surface, right? So when you look at the partial derivative of the constraint, in a point on the constraint, it has to point orthogonal. Why it is so? Well, if you consider the Taylor expansion of a point x and another point x plus epsilon, or x plus epsilon on the surface, then the Taylor expansion tells you that the value in this x plus epsilon point is the value at the original point plus epsilon times the gradient plus some epsilon squared something. These two, they are all zeros. So we get that what has to happen is that the gradient needs to be zero as well. So this was like a technical explanation, but let me show you also like an intuitive explanation. Assume that it's not the case, that the gradient is not orthogonal. I don't know, it points like this is orthogonal, so it points a bit up. So if we are in this point, move a bit, then what happens? Well, the gradient was pointing a bit upwards. So it means that this point will have a higher value of g, right? The gradient is increasing in this direction, which means it is also increasing in this direction. But if the g is increasing in this direction, then this point couldn't have a value of zero, right? But all the points on this potato have a value of zero, which means the gradient needs to be orthogonal. So that's one thing. We know how to say which direction is orthogonal to the surface. And now, in the let's say that we are seeking for a maximum, and let's say that this is a maximum. And if this is a maximum, then this gradient of the function which we want to maximize, that it also needs to be orthogonal to the constraint surface. And why is it? Well, the reason is the same as before. So if the gradient would be pointing not in orthogonal direction, then going in this direction on the constraint surface would increase the function, right? But if we have a maximum, then neither the points to the left or to the right might be larger. They cannot increase, which means the gradient of f needs to be orthogonal to the surface. But we know what the direction orthogonal to the surface is. It is gradient of g, right? So if in this constraint maximum, we know that these gradients need to be collinear so that there exists a constant such that the gradient of f plus lambda times gradient of g is zero. So this gives us a way how to find this constraint, or to solve this constraint optimization. First, we introduce the so-called Lagrangian function. That's a function which uses x and also lambda as variables. And it computes the original function fx plus lambda times gx. And what we will do is we will find the points where the gradient of this Lagrangian function will be zero, right? Let's now consider the two partial derivatives. One is this derivative of the Lagrangian function with respect to lambda, right? So, well, when this gradient is zero, it leads to this gradient is gx, right, with respect to lambda. So when this is zero, it means gx is zero, which means if we have a partial derivative equals to zero, we are lying on the decision surface. We are on the potato. And then the partial derivative with respect to x, well, if it's zero, then it means that this derivative of f plus lambda times derivative of g is also zero, which was exactly the condition which we showed here as necessary for local maximum. So that's what we can do. We can find these maximums by creating the Lagrangian function, finding points where the partial derivatives everywhere is zero, and then somehow verifying that this really is a minimum or a maximum. The result is nice because we are able to do things in the same way as before. Like, we are computing partial derivatives, we can already do it. We just combine the function and the constraint together and introduced one additional parameter, which is very nice. If we have multiple parameters, we can use induction and we can have plus lambda 2 g2 x and even more if you want to. So that's these constants, they are called Lagrange multipliers, and sometimes the whole theorem is also called Lagrange multipliers. Of course, similarly to the regular unconstrained maximization, these conditions are only necessary, they are not sufficient. So if you find a point where these derivatives are zero, it doesn't need to be a maximum. Yep. So this is something which we will use in the future of the course several times. And we'll start by using it by showing that the normal distribution is actually the one which maximizes entropy. I have talked about it, that is the case, but I think it makes sense to actually see that's the case, to get an idea of where do things come from. Right? Sometimes I think like knowing what motivated which decisions or models is even more important than some other stuff. So let's do it. This part is this danger sum symbol. So this is meant to you to like broaden your like theoretical background, which I think it's important. So first, before we get there, I need you to at least very briefly introduce you to the calculus of variations. We'll just need one theorem, so I will just give you one or two definitions and a theorem, and then we'll use it. But so far, we were able to minimize a function which processed some number of parameters. However, some functions or some operators may also take functionals on the input, functions on the input, I'm really sorry. So if we have an operator and it uses a function on the input, this operator is usually called a functional, right? So it's like function on functions. If you are using higher order functions in languages like C++ or something, then that's exactly this, right? And an example is entropy. Right? Entropy is an operator where if you give it a distribution, then you will get an entropy. And this distribution is actually a whole function in case of real-valued random variables. So that's an example of such a functional. And when we want to compute a minimum of a functional, we need to take derivatives with respect to the function. Right? So these are so-called functional derivatives, which means we want to compute the derivative of the functional of the operator with respect to the function, right? That's what we will need to do when we will compute the maximum of entropy. Like we'll try to find the distribution which has maximum entropy. And the idea is that, well, this function f, it's just a lot of points. Well, it's usually uncountable. It can be uncountable number of points, but still we could compute the derivative with respect to fx for all the x's, right? If we did this, then we could have like very naively like infinite number of partial derivatives, and we would consider them to be the derivative with respect to the function. The notation is the same as usual. We just say a partial derivative, and here we just say fx, right? So we are computing the derivative with respect to the function. Now, the theorem. We will use a theorem which will tells you how to compute the functional derivative of a function which is an integral of some function g. And this function g takes x and fx on the input. So we have some formula which uses not only x's, but also fx's. And we then compute the integral. For such functions, when we want to compute the functional derivative, then what do we do? Well, first we drop the integral, and then we compute the regular partial derivative of the function g with respect to the first argument, right? So we can imagine that this is just some y, and we just compute the partial derivative of the first argument. We don't really modify x or something, we just compute the derivative with respect to the fx, to the first argument of g. This is actually what would happen if there would be a sum instead of an integral. So if we had a function g, right, which is taking some weights as the first argument, and we would like to know what the partial derivative is with respect to one of these arguments. And the function will be defined as sum over possible weights. Then out of this sum, only one element will remain, the one with wi, right? And this one element we would compute the derivative of the first argument. And in this functional case, it's very similar. Instead of sum, we have the integral. But in any case, when this goes over all possible fx values, we are computing the gradient with fx. So we just take this one value in this point x, and we compute the derivative of g with respect to the first argument. And so in a sense, it seems like a generalization of what we already know. Yep. So just bear with me that this is really true, and we will use it. So how to find the distribution over the real valued random variables which maximizes the entropy. The entropy in this case is computed against using an integral because it's over all the real values. So the entropy we already know is the integral of px times logarithm of px, and there needs to be a minus sign here. However, we cannot just maximize entropy with respect to any function. First, this function actually needs to be a distribution. Right? Otherwise, we could modify the values and get maybe even higher and higher values. So we need to add a constraint that this actually is a distribution, and this constraint means that the probabilities sum to one, but in the case of real valued random variables, it means they integrate to one. So the area under curve of this probability of this density function is one. So that's what we will need the Lagrange multipliers for. We have some constraints we are maximizing, but using several constraints. And that's still not enough. We will need to introduce two more constraints. One is that we will fix the expectation of a distribution, because otherwise we would have multiple maxima, right? Where the same distribution would just be moved by a constant on the real axis. So what we do is we say, okay, let the expectation of the distribution be fixed to some value mu. And it's still not enough, because at this point we could get distributions with higher and higher entropy, because the entropy increases as variance increases, right? If we can generate more and more different values, like more and more errors, like we can generate predictions with higher variance, then the entropy goes even higher. So I don't know, imagine first a uniform distribution on some interval. Then what we could do is we could take the distribution on twice large interval with half the density, and that's the higher entropy. Then we could do the same thing. We could create a distribution on the even larger range with smaller probability, and so on and so on and so on. And all these wider distributions have higher entropy than before. So in order to really find maximum, we need to fix the variance. So let's say that the variance is fixed to some given sigma squared. For that, we will add the constraint that the variance of the distribution is fixed to the given constant. Now we have enough conditions, so let's get to the math. We will create the Lagrangian. Here is the entropy which we want to maximize. Well, in this case, we want to maximize it, but so we have written it with the opposite. You want to maximize it. And the constraints. So the constraints are here. First, the area under curve sums to one, multiplied by one Lagrange coefficient. Then the expectation being mu with lambda 2, and the variance being sigma squared with lambda 3. Now we will expand all the definitions to integrals, and how will it end? So first let's look at the integral part. Here we have px, so it goes here, right? Then we have this expectation, where this expectation is just px times x, right? From the definition of the expectation, so it goes here. And lambda 2 goes here. Then we have the variance. Variance is just integral of px times x minus mu, sorry, squared. Right? So this part goes here. And we have the entropy, and the entropy is just minus the integral of minus p log p. Right? So that's this part. And then there are some constant left over. There is this minus lambda 1, right, minus lambda 2 mu. And we also have this sigma squared minus lambda 3, and that's it. So now we have a Lagrangian, and we would like to find the maximum for a given function p, right? So we would compute the functional derivative. This formula is in the required format, which means the integral of some function which uses x and px. And we know that the functional derivative is just, if we take this value, we just ignore the integral, and then we compute the derivative with respect to px, keeping x where it is. So this part will, like this px will cancel, we will get lambda 1. In the second part, px will cancel, we will get lambda 2x. In this third part, px will cancel, we will get lambda 3x minus mu squared. And here in the last part, we need to compute the derivative of multiplication. So it's the first one times the derivative of the second one. And the derivative of the first one times the second one. Right? So these are exactly those values. And now we can look at what values actually have this partial derivative equal functional derivative equal to zero, right? Well, when we look at the equation, we find out that it actually gives us a form of p, right? Because if this left hand side should be equal to the right hand side, then it means that the logarithm of px is equal to this, which means the px itself is logarithm to the exponentiation function where we use this lambda 1 plus lambda 2 x plus lambda 3 x minus mu squared minus 1 as a parameter. Now we don't, so this already tells us that the probability density will be an exponential function. We would like to come up with these lambda parameters. One way how to do it is that we know that all these three constraints need to be satisfied. And by like the P here will contain all these lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3. And if we solve for these lambdas, we will get this solution that lambda 1 is lambda 2, lambda 3 looks somehow. And when we put them in, we will get exactly the normal distribution. So this is the main part, right, of the normal distribution. So this will be minus x minus mu squared divided by 2 sigma squared. This part will not be here at all. And then this lambda 1 minus 1, it doesn't depend on x, so it will deal with a normalization constant, right? So it will deal with this 1 over square root of 2 pi sigma squared, which is there as the constant in the normal distribution. And that's what it will do, right? So what we have done is we have arrived at the normal distribution formula just from the definition of entropy, the some mathematical techniques for finding minimums, and that's it. So it's a way how you can like come up with this weird and long formula. It also means that, for example, using mean square error for linear regression comes all the way to entropy, right? Because if you decide what entropy looks like, then you can derive the normal distribution from it, and from the normal distribution you can actually derive the mean square error, right? Because this mean square error, that's just the value of this exponent, and the value of this exponent is mostly this. So once we have said what entropy is and that we believe maximum entropy principle, then we have got a lot out of it, including the Gaussian and the mean square error. So this one thing. Are there any questions? I don't know. Are you following me? How is going? Well, hopefully it's going fine. Nobody has any comments. So that was one theoretical part of this lecture. We will also use the maximum principle again. And this time we will use it to derive the softmax activation function. I was always wondering, like, where do these sigmoids, softmaxes come from? Like, why you just like get it? Why it's a good function for logistic regression? And this is one of the possible answers, which shows that actually softmax can be derived just from the maximum entropy principle. So in a sense, it's a model which is the most general, like it's a form of a model which should have as least additional knowledge built in as possible. So once again, it will be a bit tricky, but not that much. We won't need the calculus of variations at all. So it will be easier. Imagine that we have got a data set. The inputs are d like vectors with d values, so d features, and the targets are just the indexes of the k class classification. So they range from 1 to k. We want to model the data using some function pi. This function will get an input example, and it will produce the distribution over the classes. Right, so that's exactly what our model will be in the end. Right, this pi x, that's just the multi-class or multi-label logistic regression, or softmax logistic regression. So, but at this point, we don't really talk about how it should look like, right? It's just some abstract function. However, it cannot be just any function, right? We want it to be interpreted as a distribution. So for that, we need two conditions. First, all the values are probabilities, so they are non-negative, and they sum to one. And then we will introduce another condition, and it will be a very important one. We want this function to model the data, right? To somehow correspond to the labels in the train set. And how we will do it, like, imagine that you have, I don't know, we have seen a die, several rolls of a six-sided die, and you have seen some number of counts. So you know, okay, I know that I've seen count one two times, and two I've seen three times, and so on and so on. And then you can somehow think of what the real distribution is. We will also like look at it a bit in this way. And for, like, let's say that we have a feature K and we have a class J. And when we look at this one specific feature and one class, we can be interested in knowing how much is this kth feature being, like, how much it is present for the examples in the jth class. So I don't know, imagine that you are trying to find some correlation or you are predicting weight of some human, and one of these features which you have is also height, right? Then this right hand side, what it does is that it looks at the examples which belong only to class J and sum their kth feature, right? So this would, for example, be the sum of heights of people which are classified as heavy, for example. So in a sense, this is like the amount of feature K, which is present for the class J. So it's like the amount of this feature value, which somehow is used as an evidence for the class J. So these are like the counts in a sense, right? But we don't just count zero or one, we count the full features, right? So what we count is the sum of this feature K for the examples J. And what we want to do is we want to keep this count. When, for example, some specific height or some average height was, or if the people who are classified as heavy have some number of centimeters in total, we want the model to keep this relation. So we want to keep this sum of features belonging to the class J not to change, right? So when we have a model, this model returns the whole distribution. So for a single example, we get the distribution for all J classes, right? So when we compute like how what is the sum of the kth feature for class J, it's a weighted sum of these kth classes. And so this is the sum of the feature K, which our distribution things belong to the class J, and we want these things to be the same. Like this is, on the first sight, it's definitely not the first condition you would like to say. Like you maybe could say, okay, I want just this label of this first input to be T1, right? But the problem is that it may be like specific or non-nice example. I don't know, it may look like this. It's not very nice too. So, or it may look like, okay, I'm trying to find something which will, okay, it may be like this, right? So that's, and we would say that this is a 5, right? But the problem is that it also looks a bit like 6. Like the data doesn't include this information, but this pi, it might, right? This pi, if it doesn't know the labels, it might say, okay, so this looks a bit like 5 and also like 6. But in total, we want the kth feature to participate in the jth class in the same way as before. So the counts of the features for jth class needs to be the same, both for the data and for the distribution pi. Now, we could, for example, use one particularly bad distribution pi, which would just be the training data. So for a given input, it would just say the class of the eth example, if it is equal to the eth example. And otherwise, we would just say 0. We don't know anything, right? So this is extremely overfitted model, because it can only recognize the training data and nothing else, right? It's actually exactly this right-hand side, right? This can be used as this policy pi, sorry, it's not a policy, as this function pi. However, it's really unuseful because it will give you no prediction for any data outside of the train set. So what would we want is to get a more general pi, and we will find the more general pi, the most general pi, by computing the one with maximum entropy. Now we are ready to do the computation. So right now we have already done all the important things. We have explained the constraint which we want to be fulfilled, and we want to just compute how would this most probable how would this pi with maximum entropy look like. So we want to maximize the entropy. We want to maximize it for all the training examples, and the entropy for one training example is the sum over all possible classes, the probability of that class times logarithm of the probability of that class. The constraints are the first two ones describe that the pi is a distribution, and then we have the third one, which tells you that the amount of features participating in examples with label J needs to be the same as in the data as given by the distribution pi. Once again, we need to do a constraint optimization. There is also an inequality constraint, which we didn't talk about yet how to handle. So we will just ignore it for the time being, and we will see that it will be fulfilled automatically. So even if we don't say that we want this to be fulfilled, it will happen by itself, hopefully. So we have two constraints. So what the Lagrangian looks like? Well, this third constraint, it's actually a lot of constraints, one for each feature, one for each class. So, okay, so for each feature and for each class, we have one constraint. So we have a specific Lagrange multiplier for that class and for that feature. And the constraint says this, right? So that's here on this part. So these are the constraints that the counts need to be preserved. Then we have a constraint saying that the sum of the probabilities needs to be one. There are as many constraints as examples. So we get a B1 one for each example. And here we have the constraint that the probabilities need to sum to one. And then we have the entropy itself, right? Minus the sum of P times log P. Yep. Now we need to compute the partial derivatives. And what we will do is we will compute the partial derivatives of all the outputs of this pi function. Even if the pi is a function, we will only evaluate it on the training data. So we don't need to compute the functional derivatives. We just consider these to be variables and we just compute the regular partial derivatives. So how does the result look like? Well, the result looks like this. Let's say that we are computing the gradient with respect to, or the derivative with respect to xij, so the class j and example x. So here in the beginning, here is pi x1j. So when we compute the derivative, what will be left here, we will have a sum over k of lambda kj times xik. Right. These are the elements of this first sum, which contains this pi xij. There are also a lot of other elements, but they don't contain either the xi or the jth output of the function. We can write this as a vector product of lambda, anything j and the xi. And so that's the first element. Then here, out of this sum, only one element will be kept. It will be multiplied by b1. So the another part here is plus bi. And then we have the derivative of the entropy. We have already seen that, right? So we are computing the derivative of p. Okay, so let's do it correctly. Pi xij times the logarithm of pi xij, and that is the derivative of a multiplication. So it's the derivative of the first one times the second, so that's this logarithm, and the derivative of the second one, which is 1 over pi times the first, which is this minus 1. And now again, setting the Lagrangian to 0, we get an equation which will tell us something about the form of this pi xij. Right? That's very similar to what we did for the normal distribution. And we will rewrite it. So we can just rewrite it and see that this pi xij is the exponentiation of some function. This function is a linear function of x plus some constants. So how can we decrease the number of constants? We will get rid of this beta, right? So in order to get rid of this beta. Now, yeah, first, if these numbers are the result of an exponentiation function, they are positive. So we have automatically fulfilled this condition, which we didn't add it to the list of constraints which need to be satisfied, but they are automatic. And then in order to get rid of the beta I, we will use the fact that the sum of all the probabilities for all the classes needs to sum to one, right? Which means that sum over all these forms which we have computed here needs to sum to one. And from that, we can easily get that e to beta 1 needs to be equal to the rest. So it will need to be equal to 1 over sum of over all j's of this e to lambda something j x I minus 1. And substituting this to the current form of pi, we get the following, that the pi xij is e to like a vector of lambdas times vector of xi divided by the sum over all these possible sums for all the example, for all the different classes for this example. And this is softmax actually, right? This is softmax of lambda something j times xi. So not only did we arrive at the result which says that, okay, using the softmax is a good idea. That's the solution with maximum entropy. It also describes the model itself as a linear model, like we see that the pi is actually like a linear model followed by the softmax activation. So this linearity is also built in the constraints, like we want the amount of the kth feature to be the same as prescribed by the training data. So when you say that you want to fulfill this, not only you get the softmax activation, but also the fact that the model needs to be linear. And all these Lagrange multipliers, these lambdas, they are actually the weights which we try to optimize when training the algorithm, right? So up until now, we know that this is a good solution. We don't know what values of these lambdas should actually have. Well, but that's what's exactly what we do when we train the algorithm, right? Because when we train a logistic regression in multi-class, we are actually finding the lambdas to minimize the maximum likelihood estimation. Yep. So any comments, questions, something? So I know that it has been a bit theoretical today, but I believe that knowing how these functions came to be is an important understanding. And even if you can imagine multiple possibilities of what the binary classification activation should be, or other possibilities how to predict distributions, that this softmax function is in a sense the most general one, the one with has maximum entropy. So it makes sense to use it, and even if some other possibilities also exist, unless we know something more, unless we know some additional constraints, then this softmax is a good default, right? That's what these theorems tells us. Okay, so now let's forget for a bit that we did a lot of computations, and let's get back to some other issues. First, I would like to talk to you about evaluating binary classification. Right? Up until now, when we were performing binary classification, we just used accuracy. The accuracy told us, okay, when we did the prediction, this was the percentage of actually producing the correct output. But accuracy has Accuracy works reasonably well when we have the when the like number of instances in the different classes is reasonably similar. But if the classification is really unbalanced, one of these classes is much larger than the other one, then the accuracy is not a great is a great metric. I don't know. Imagine that you have some that you would like to detect. I don't know. For example, in this thyroid competition, like we tried to find out patients which had problems with their thyroid. And out of very many patients, only some of them are have actually some problems. So if, I don't know, at least C percent of the data is the so-called positive. So when we are doing the binary classification, so we will call the results now positive and negative. So if there are some number of the positive examples, then I don't know, imagine that this is like 5%. Then the accuracy of any classifier should be at least one minus, like 100 minus C percent. Right. Accuracy of any classifier should be at least 95% when C is 5, because that's the accuracy of the classifier which always says nobody. Everybody is negative, right? But because there is too little positive examples, we get very high accuracy. So using accuracy in these cases is not that useful. Instead, we would more like to be like we would like to concentrate only on the positive on the positive class. And such a metric is, for example, F1 score. So before we define it, we need to talk like we need to define some terminology. We have the positives and negative examples, and either they are positive and negative because they are positive and negative in the data, or they are positive or negative because they were predicted by the classifier to be positive and negative. So we will have the in the target data, if an example is positive, it's a target positive or a target negative. And we have also sometimes you can say gold positive and gold negative, and the result of the classification of the model is predicted positive and predicted negative, and this gives us four possible four categories of the results. Either we predicted positive and it was correct, so these are so-called true positives, and we'll use TP for them, right? We said it's positive and it was positive. And if we said it's positive but it's really negative, then they are false positives, right? So this is what we predicted, right? We predicted positive, and either it was a good prediction or a false one. And the same for the negatives. So we have negatives. The negatives can be true negatives, which means they are really negatives, or they can be false negatives, which means that they are in fact positive, even if we said negative. We can also like look at it on this right picture. So here are the gold positive elements, right? These are gold negative on the right side, and this circle in the middle, that's the positive elements which were predicted by the model, and some of them are true positives. Yep. And then we missed some of the positive examples. And these are false negatives, right? We said that they are negative, but they are actually not. So they are false negatives. And then the same thing on the right-hand side, right? So this is the true negative. This is what we predicted correctly. And this is the erroneous part where we said, okay, these are positives. And in fact, they are negative. This like matrix with the results, it's sometimes called a confusion matrix. And I assume you have already seen it in many other places. I'm sorry, I just moved with this screen sharing rectangle. Yep. I assume you have already seen seen it, because there are very many metrics, matrices, metric, which can be defined using this, even if small, confusion matrix. Even when we talk about statistical testing, you also look at the results of the test in this way. So when you want to define accuracy, you can do it easily. You can look at the true positives and the true negatives. Right? This is the these are the cases where you predicted the correct output, and then you just divide it by all the data. Right, that's what the accuracy is. So we can say it's all the true results divided by all the results available. But as we said, in many situations, this true negative class is not that important because there are a lot of negative examples. So instead, we would like to concentrate on these three other numbers, right? They somehow detected or connected with the positive classes. And we will define two metrics. One will be precision. So precision, it's if you say that something is positive, then the precision tells you what accuracy does this statement have. So when you look at whatever you pronounce to be positive, accuracy tells you what part of it is actually a true positive. So that's precision. So true positives divided by true positives and false positives. If you are, I don't know, let's say that we are designing a test for this COVID disease, then precision means that if you go to the test and you are positive, then with and the test says you are positive, what is the probability that it's really the case, right? So that's the precision of the test. Let's do the second example later. So that's one thing, precision. Getting a high precision can be like, if let's say that you have a classifier, we would like to generate, you would like to increase precision. What you could do is you could try generating examples or predicting positive only when you are very certain, right? To increase the precision, you just like drop off the gray cases and you just keep the very likely ones. For example, in when we are doing some binary classification, we could use not just 0.5 as the threshold of the probability, but I don't know, 0.8 or 0.9. So we would produce examples only when the model is extremely sure and just disregard the rest. So that's one way how, that's one new metric. And the second metric, which we will talk about, is recall. Recall somehow deals with the target positive cases. And the recall tells you what percentage of the correct predictions is in the GOT example. So this is not a nice description. So this is, in a sense, a detection rate, right? It means how large or what amount of the positive examples you are able actually to detect using the classifier, right? So we take the true positive and divide it by the true positives and false negatives, because these are like all the positive examples in the data. Here you can also see it like in some other visual notation. Precision is just how well I predicted the positive classes, meaning when I said positive, how good it was. And the recall tells you how much of the positive examples in the whole data I can actually discover by using the classifier. So for this COVID test, recall would tell you how what is the portion of the people who are actually infected that are discovered by the test. Now, if you would like to increase recall for a given classifier, what you could do is you could take the threshold and decrease it. Right? Instead of using a threshold of 0.5, you could say 0.3. So even if the model is not certain, you can say, okay, so maybe this is really a positive result, right? So you can increase it by decreasing the threshold. And the precision was going the other way around. So in a sense, these two metrics, precision and recall, they go against each other. What you can do is you can create their dependence, to create something which is called a precision recall curve. The precision recall curve is a curve which you get by moving the threshold of your algorithm, right? When the threshold is extremely high, then you have very small recall, but probably very high precision, right? Imagine that you output only the first, well, if the threshold would be like extremely high, one, then you would say that nothing is positive, and it's a question what the precision would be. But if you classify like one example where the model is the most sure as being positive, then it's very likely that it will really be positive. So you will have 100% precision and you will have extremely low recall because you have found only one example. And then when this threshold decreases, the recall is increasing, right? And when you do some mistake, when you do an error, then the precision will go down, right? So that's why there are some jumps down, which means you made a problem, made a mistake, but generally you can see that you will get curve which will show you like what dependence do these recall and precision have. And then when we know that they are like going against each other, that generally means that you start with precision high and recall low, and then get to the case where the recall is high and the precision is low. Then having two numbers, that's not really great. So what we could do instead of like thinking about all these, instead of having two matrix which go against each other, we could have only one, and somehow combining the results together. And that's exactly what this F1 score is. An F1 score is harmonic mean of precision and recall. Like there are various means, like there is the averaging mean, like if you have two numbers, you can just say x plus y divided by 2. You can have a geometric mean, right, something like this. And there is also harmonic mean, which computes the like uses the inverse of the values, right, something like this. And that's exactly what the F1 score is. So it's 2 over 1 over precision plus 1 over recall, and after some basic changes, you will get to the following formula, that the F1 score is 2 times precision times recall divided by precision plus recall. So whenever the precision or recall is low, the resulting F1 score will also be low, because they are multiplied here, right? So whenever one of these is low or substantially low or even zero, then the F1 score is also very very small. The F1 score goes from 0 to 100 to 1, like in the best case scenario, it has a value of 1. So it's usually reported in percentages, even if the percentages doesn't mean the number of tokens which are classified as positives or negatives. It's just a quantity which combines precision and recall. Now, here we have assumed that the precision and recall are of the same importance to us, but that might not be the case. For example, consider that you are implementing a search, right? You have a collection of documents, and then you want to say that some of these documents are actually the one which you are searching for. So that will be our positive class. Then if the search should go on the Google website, right? Then the precision is the most important, because precision means when we have said that these 10 documents should be on this on the website, how many of them are actually good? How many of them are suitable for the query? Like, how many of them are actually the positive ones, the good ones? And generally, when you want to search for something, I don't know, for a magpie, then there are very many pages on the web. And you care a lot about actually showing 10 very nice pages. And that's what the precision is for. Like, it tells you, okay, from whatever you returned, these are the good things. However, if you would be searching instead on a web, in your mail archive, right? Let's say that you want to find a mail, I don't know, you have asked me how to solve some assignment, and now you would like to find the mail. And you are not really sure how the mail was, but you have some idea. Okay, so there was this word there probably or something. So you try to search for it. Now, you probably don't have million or billions of mails in your mailbox, which was the case in the web search, right? So when you want to show mails filtered for some query, then usually you care about recall more, right? You want to make sure that all the mails which are relevant, all the ones which contain the information which you are searching for, are actually displayed. Well, maybe some additional ones are as well, but if you get 50 results, you can just look at them and see what you wanted to go for, right? So in these cases, recall is a more natural or the more important part, because it tells you, okay, I am sure that I won't miss anything, right? That's what the recall does. If you have high recall, it means you are not missing any positive. If you have high precision, it means you are not wasting time with something which you said positive and it's not, right? So that tells you how successful you are in predicting this positive label. So by default, this F1 score combines them using the same strength or same strength. However, sometimes it might be useful to say, okay, I care more about recall or I care more about precision. There are even cases where you only want to measure recall or only want to measure precision, but if you are combining it together, you might even want to say, okay, I like this or this. So this F1 score, this one, can be actually generalized to F beta score, where the recall is beta times more important than precision, right? So this parameter will allow us to say the weight of recall. So in practice, F2 is used. That's a version of F score which favors recall, right? It's 2 times more important, whatever it is. And F half is a distribution. It's a score which favors precision. For example, when you do grammar error correction, then this F half is used usually, because when you correct somebody their text, and it's incorrect, then they are usually not very satisfied. However, not finding an error seems like a smaller problem, right? So this allows you, this weight to somehow weight between the false positives and false negatives, right? That's what this beta do. Like in the F score, you are somehow combining these three values together, and this beta tells you whether the false positives or the false negatives are more important to you. We have already seen that moving with the threshold influence the precision and recall, right? So if you are interested, if you have this precision recall curve, you for each point on the precision recall curve, you will get an F score, for each threshold. And it's not obvious that the one for 0.5 will be the highest. So So if you have a train classifier and you would like to maximize the F score, F1 score, what you can do is you can actually fiddle with the threshold. When you have a development set, you can measure your F1 score with various values of the threshold, and you will see whether it actually you'll be able to see whether 0.5 is actually the one with the maximum F1 score. Yep. So when we talked about this F1 score, we talked that it's useful in the situations where we don't want to consider these true negatives at all, right? These true negatives, for example, for our thyroid competition, this is by far the largest class, right? But the F score doesn't really look at it. It only looks at the people who are positive or at the predictions which are positive, but it doesn't include these true negatives, which is fine for these cases. However, when we talked about the precision and recall curve, we might be interested in doing something like this, getting some curve for general binary classification. And in the general case, we might be interested in actually considering the true negatives, right? Because not doing so might be not that great if we are processing data which are balanced or something. So you can encounter a different curve, this time not the precision recall curve, but so-called ROC, I don't know how it should be pronounced in English, ROC curve maybe. It's receiver operating characteristic. It's really a name which I cannot see how, just from hearing the name, it's difficult to get an idea of what's happening. But it's a curve which, once again, shows you some trade-off of your classifier. So if you have a classifier, then what will happen if you will increase or decrease the threshold? But contrary to the precision and recall curve, it shows the dependency of different metrics. One of them is the true positive rate that's actually recall. So one of these is actually recall, and it tells you there's a probability of detection written here. That's the probability that you will detect a positive example. And this is being computed from true positives and false negatives. I'm wondering whether, yes. However, the second one is not precision. Precision is computed from these values, right? But we said we also want to include the true negatives. So the next value which we want to consider is sometimes called a false positive rate. So it means the probability of false alarm that you set positive and it's not. The probability, yeah. So that value should be computed from these two. It would be this false positive rate would be false positive divided by false positive plus true negative. Right. This way, we really use all the values. Like the one tells us, okay, what's the probability of actually detect the positive class? And the second tells us what the probability is to detect the negative class, but in the opposite way. Right. So in a sense, these two values have similar or symmetric meaning, unlike the values in the F score. Similarly, by moving the threshold, we can get a curve like this. In the IEA classifier would look like this. Like it would get one true positive rate and zero false positive rate. Right. So it will be just a point here. By the way, the original or the optimal value for the precision recall curve will be just a point up here. And generally, the worse the classifier is, the less it gets to the bottom right in this ROC curve, and more to the left and bottom in the precision and recall curve. There is a visualization which shows you like the sources of the errors here. Imagine that we have got this data. So these are the true positives ones, right? These are the true negatives. Okay, these are the target positives, yes, and these are the target negatives. There is some overlap. Now we have this threshold where the model will say, okay, so I will classify all these as negatives and I will classify all these as positives. Now, some of them will be true positive, that's fine. However, these will be false negatives because they are target positives, but I did it correctly, right? And the similar for the negative ones. It seems the colors are not really correct, right? This true negatives should go all the way up until here. Okay, let me fix it. Just took it and didn't look too much on it. So these are the true negatives, and here are the false positives on the right side. And by moving this threshold, you see that you will somehow move, shuffle these numbers around. Probably the best threshold will be here in the middle. That seems most likely. Right, and you can find this point on the precision recall curve or on the ROC curve, depending on what you are actually dealing with. In many papers or in some papers, you can see like both of these curves for the model the authors trained for some specific problem at hand. Yep. When you really go to the do the all hard work and draw all these curves, then using these curves, like these curves can also be used as metrics, and especially we could use the area under the curve, right? And the higher the area is, the better the classifier we have. And the thing is, normally if you have a precision recall or F1 score, then usually that's the score which you get for the threshold 0.5. But well, one thing is that maybe some other threshold is better, and also it depends how like robust the classifier is for different thresholds. So then using this area under curve as a metric is a good idea, because it gives you the overall performance of the classifier even for different values of the threshold. So we will, well, not on this lecture, but on some other lectures, which I also have, the people usually measure things by using this area under curve. For example, I don't know, if you do object detection, if you want to find objects in the given image, then that's usually also evaluated using this area under some precision recall curve. Yep. So are there any questions? By the way, to see some real numbers, we have this thyroid competition approaching. Its deadline is approaching. And what I will do is that in the final results, you will not only see the accuracy, which we will still use as our primary metric, but we will also use, also compute the F1 score. So you will see how well it does or does not correlate with the accuracy which you have seen until now. Yep. So any questions? No. Okay. Then we still have 7 minutes. So let's get to the last topic of today's lecture. And that's the distinction between parametric and non-parametric methods. All the models which we have seen until now are so-called parametric models or parametric methods, because they use a fixed number of parameters. So that's why they are parametric, because they have parameters, and by having parameters we mean that there is like a fixed number of them. These parameters that are the weights of our models, that's what we have been trained, what we have been training so far. Usually these parameters, they depend on the number of features, or maybe the number of classes for the MLP, also for the size of the hidden layer, and maybe some additional ones, right? But these are, they are fixed. So if you have more data or less data, the size of the model is the same. The capacity of the model stays constant. On the contrary, we could have the non-parametric methods or non-parametric models. And these, well, it kind of seems that they don't have any parameters, like when they are non-parametric, but that's definitely not the case. The main distinction is that they don't have a fixed number of parameters. So usually they have number, like the number of parameters in these methods somehow depends on the size of the data, right? So in a sense, these models can increase in capacity if they get more training data. So instead of non-parametric, it should be called, like, I don't know, like dynamic capacity or dynamic number of parameters or something, but they are just called non-parametric. And to show you an example, consider the following algorithm or the following method, which is called a k-nearest neighbor method. Maybe you have already heard it. It's a simple and surprisingly effective algorithm. And it's a non-parametric method. It can be used to perform both classification and regression. How does it work? Well, in the simplest version, which is just one nearest neighbor, like this, like one nearest neighbor. So imagine that we want to perform a classification of digits, like the solve the NIST competition. In order to do so, what we could do is we could just keep the whole training data set. And then when we get a new, value, we will try to find the most similar example in the training data. So let's say that it's this, right? Let's say that it looks like this. Right? And then when we have found the most similar example, we'll just reuse its target. So its class or its value in case it's a regression. This is probably an algorithm which everybody would come up with when they will be asked to somehow create an algorithm which will train, which will learn from the data, right? The more data you have, the better you probably are. It can be shown that actually, if you have a limited number of data, this algorithm works very well. It can be generalized to use not just one nearest neighbor, but some higher number of nearest neighbors, in which case, you will find k members, right? Let's say that I will find three. And I will somehow combine the target of all of them. So if we are, I am computing a regression, I can just say, okay, so that's the target of each of them divided by three, or generally by k, right? For classification, what you can do is you can imagine that every example defines a distribution, a categorical distribution, and again you will just take the categorical distribution and compute the average of the distributions, and then like if you just want to perform the classification, you can find the class which has got the maximum value, which is just voting of these neighbors and nothing else. We can also use some weighted variant of this algorithm, so that when you are using, I don't know, 10 nearest neighbors, you might want the neighbors which are closer to play a higher role in the final classification, right? So in the general, what we do is we find k most similar examples in the training data, and then we compute the weights for each of them so that it's a distribution, so that these weights, they sum to one, right? In the non-weighted version, this is just a uniform distribution, so each of them is 1 over k, but generally they're going to be different. And then the final result is just the WITI. And in case of classification, this is the whole distribution, so a lot of zeros and one for one of the classes. The question is like how to measure similarity. Right, when we have data and some other data in the like example in the training data, well, the simple possibility what to use is just to really compute the distance. Like usually the data are just vectors, so we can just say okay, so let's just compute like the distance of these two vectors. So that's being used quite a lot. Then for the weights. So either we just use the uniform weights, right? So we are not weighting at all. Or we need to use some distribution. So what we could do, for example, we could use a softmax of these distances, right? These distances, they get larger the more further you are. So in the weights, you want to compute measure similarity. So you actually want to take the negative of the distances, right? Maybe there should be some gamma coefficient which tells you like how much do you want really to take these distances in account, like how far the question is whether the submax should look like this or whether it should like this, and that's what the gamma actually does, right? It's a trade-off between whether you want just to take the closest example or whether you want to consider all of them independently. So this gamma allows you to set the strength of the weights or of the similarity which you are using. Yep. So you have probably seen that these slides are not really finished as well as I would like to. This course is going for the second year, so some of these slides are still new, and sometimes I don't finish them as well as I want. So I'm sorry for that. I will definitely finish them and update them in the repository. And here I've at least drawn the content for you. So that's all I had prepared. So thank you for your attention. If you don't have any questions, feel free to go home and, I don't know, enjoy a nice walk outside or something. But if you still have any questions, then please don't hesitate to ask. I'm here. And if not, then bye and see you. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Sorry, why do we? We discussed this when we were talking about the entropy itself, and the idea is that the entropy measures the amount of surprise, of unsureness in the data. So when we want to find a general, like the most general solution, then we want the one which contains like as highest surprise as possible. Like the most general means that we can predict the least using that solution. So I don't know. Imagine that we are we have a six-sided die, right? 4, 5, 6. We know them, like this is the example which we already used. So we have the probabilities of these. Now the question is, like, what do you like if you want to estimate the probability, what do we put here? And if you look at it from the entropy point of view, so if all these would get the same same probability, then the amount of like surprise or the amount of information would be the highest, right? Because if they have equal probability, we can predict the least what will happen. On the other hand, if instead we said, okay, all the probability will go to 4 and nothing to 5 and nothing to 6, then this will have a very low entropy because there is no surprise, right? We know that it's 4. Or like compared with 1, 2, 3, it doesn't need to be always 4. It can be also 1, 2, and 3. But generally, there is less number of chances to choose to select from. Like we can be more sure of the result, which means the entropy will be lower. Right. So the higher entropy means we cannot predict as much. It means and that's why we formulated this maximum entropy principle, which told us that the distribution with maximum entropy is the one which is the most general, where we can predict the least amount. If we have some... Yes. Yeah. So when we are training a machine learning model, then this general, it has the same word base as the generalization error, and it's actually the common concept. Like when we have a model which we train on some data, then we want it in a sense to be able to process also some additional data. So that's why we want it to be general, so that it doesn't apply only on the training data which we are seeing, but it will also apply on some data which we have not yet seen. For example, in the softmax function, like one way what we could do is we could say, okay, this function which we are searching for, right, it could be just the training data and nothing else. So we could just say, okay, for the training data we'll just do whatever the data tells us to do, and for the other ones I will just do nothing. This also fits the data. It has all the conditions. But the problem is that it's too specific. It only applies to the training data and nothing else. So from the entropy point of view, it has lower entropy because whenever we are outside of the training data, we know what will happen. We will just get to zero and nothing else. But that's not what we want. Instead, we would like to have a solution with the like highest uncertainty, like the highest surprise, and that's the one with the maximum entropy. And that's like in this specific case, this is like a heavily overfitted solution because it can only work on the train set, while the generalization error is really like extreme. On the other hand, the solution with the maximum entropy tries to like give some like. The problem with this solution is that it gives you a peak distribution everywhere. The one we are searching for is a distribution where we have like the highest uncertainty in the classification. So if we have things like, I don't know, this weird thing, like it's either 5 or 6. So in the training data, you just find the more close one, and then they then say this is 5 and not really a 6. However, the distribution with the maximum entropy will try to give the highest number or largest probability to as many classes as possible, right? So we are rewarded by saying this is 5. It also seems similar to 6 and maybe similar to 8. And that's what the maximum entropy tries to do. It tries to put as much probability to the like wide range of classes. So it considers not just this one label in the data, but it tries to find like all possibilities of what this could be. And that's useful because then if we get like something we might hope to, like instead of really just taking the label from the data, the solution of the maximum entropy tries to like distribute the distribution so that it can consider as much cases as possible. while still fulfilling this condition. Like without this, well, it's, I understand that it's just the principle. So we just, it's just something as I said that we want to do. Like without this condition, if we wanted the maximum entropy, it would just be uniform solution. So it would just say, okay, everything is with probability of 10%. It kind of makes sense at the beginning. Like if you haven't seen the image, and these are probably good prior probabilities that you don't know anything. But then once you see something, then there is of course some boundary between, I don't know, specificity and sensitivity, but that's not what this is. Yeah, okay, so I've somehow got lost in the last two sentences, I'm sorry. You're welcome. Some other questions? Doesn't seem so. Okay, so thank you very much for your attention. We will see each other on the Wednesday practicals, hopefully. So enjoy your time until then, and see you around.